Hello, a very, very warm welcome to episode 61 of the series entitled The Gita Decoded. In the series, we went through the Bhagavad Gita chapter by chapter to try and give you, the viewer, a fresh and new way of understanding what is contained in this ancient Indian scripture. In this part of the series, we are looking at motives and how the subject of motives is raised within the chapters of the Bhagavad Gita. We want you, the viewer, to understand the motivations behind your actions and to see how it impacts on your speech and your behavior and the karma that is caused as a result. To answer all of these questions for us and to take us through the relevant aspects of the Bhagavad Gita or the relevant chapters of the Bhagavad Gita that are applicable in this context, I would like to introduce you to Sister Denise, who has been with us for the duration of this series, answering questions that have arisen. Sister Denise, it's always great to have you in our studio. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
Motives. I am not alone if I say that I do not look at the reason behind each and everything that I do or the words that I speak. And one has to read the Bhagavad Gita once to realize that a very strong emphasis is placed on motives. Almost at the beginning of this book, the reader's attention is drawn to what motivates you to action, what motivates you to speech. Could you tell us why it is important that we know this?
I think the important thing to realize is that just an action by itself, without its context, without its motive, can't really be evaluated. You can say, okay, do not steal. And then a corporation will say, well, I have to because of my shareholders. And it's not really stealing, it's business, you know. And so you get a lot of justifications of what you're doing so that it's not really stealing, it's something else. Then you get someone who is having an extramarital affair and saying, well, you know, it was love and we have to respect the power of love and there isn't any love left in my marriage, so therefore it's okay, it's not really infidelity. So all of these things really make you need to have to look at what your criteria are for right action. And this brings up the question of moral reasoning. And normally what you have in this world is a whole set of injunctions that people operate by. And they tend to be a little bit rigid. And certainly people who operate by those, they also tend to be quite rigid in their thinking. But when you look at motives, it takes you away from the rigidity of thinking. So you have to look into your heart and your intention. Do you have a pure intention? How do you evaluate that purity? What do you have to check it against to know whether it's pure or not? If you are looking at your karma and seeing, okay, am I doing a right karma or not a right karma? Well, who is the final judge? Ultimately, it's not people. Ultimately, it's God. And so this is why this sacred conversation between Krishna and Arjuna, between Arjuna and God, is so important, because he's saying, you know, if you are following the conventional directives about things, you will actually be missing the right information. So I, God, am giving you this secret knowledge, right information about what is right and what is wrong and the context and the destiny and so many different criteria that we have to really start thinking all over again. The problem is that people have difficulty with this, and so it's easier to just make a reference to existing prevailing social attitudes or laws and then stay within that. But then there are many instances where the voice of conscience will say, that's not right. So you have a moral dilemma where the voice of conscience says one thing and the voice of the law says something different. And then within the law, you also have the letter of the law and the spirit of the law. So you can see that at every step, being able to really look at your motives is going to make you an independent thinker and is going to make you close to doing the right thing each time. So it's really very good.
Sister Denise, could you tell our viewers what impact your motive has on the quality of the action that you perform?
Everything has been described as sattvic, rajasic, and tamasic. And so if you're motivated by those considerations that are described as sattvic, then you would be justified in saying, I'm having a pure motivation. Then the rajasic type of person is motivated differently, and so their actions are rajasic because of that different motivation. And then the tamasic person's motivation is also correspondingly impure, low, base, and so those actions would be considered impure and base. So then the karmic consequences would be accordingly. The kind of circumstances you find yourself in would be accordingly. And so this is why people are categorized in these different levels. People are not equal according to the Gita. There's higher level people, middle level people, and lower level people. And of course, this is why there's the system of the castes, you know, and the nature. It talks about your nature.
Sister Denise, we are being watched by individuals who are born into a certain race, born into a certain culture, born into a certain religion. And within that, within your family education as well as your worldly education, we learn a set of values of what is right and what is wrong, okay? Above and beyond our own sense of what is right and what is wrong. All of that has an impact on our decision-making process.
Absolutely.
And how then does one manage all of that in light of what the Bhagavad Gita says about motives? How do you do what is best and right for you? And sometimes take into account what you are taught as a child and as an adult. And sometimes, this is the difficult one, where you've got to go against what you are taught and the way you were brought up. How do you walk that walk?
It's a difficult one because as a child, you absorb whatever are the value systems of your parents, the society in which you grow up. But once you start to become a teenager, maybe once you start to be exposed to things that may shock you or don't gel with your inner ethical process, do not correspond to the voice of your conscience, then you find yourself in quite a difficult situation because you will see that what you think is right, everybody else around you thinks is wrong, and vice versa. So it makes you an outsider, and that's difficult because people want to be part of, they want to belong, but if you belong to a group whose prevailing social attitudes do not correspond to your conscience, then to be true to yourself, you have to be an outsider. To be true to your group, you have to go against your conscience. So it puts people in a very difficult situation.
It does. Sister Denise, now that we have heard in the Bhagavad Gita that one should pay great attention to the motivation behind action and speech, and the expression renouncing the fruit of action has come up innumerable times throughout the scripture, what is the responsibility? What is it incumbent upon an individual to do before he speaks, before he acts? Do you sit down every time you've got to make any decision and ask yourself, what am I doing? Why am I doing this? Won't you drive yourself nuts if you do that?
Of course, it depends on the person. And some people, they're very sensitive to the voice of conscience, and they will feel very uncomfortable doing things against their conscience. People like that, they will sit and decide, is this right, is this wrong, by their own inner criteria. Then people who go according to the external criteria, they will have been strongly trained according to that, so they will be very aware of the external criteria, and they will respond to that. Very few people are willing to go against the value system that they grew up in, because it puts them as an outsider. It sort of excommunicates them, and they have to be very strong, very forthright, very willful to do that. You can compare this with the situation of a whistleblower. The society either doesn't know, or the truth has been concealed, and then someone or some group of people come to know that something that is considered widely accepted as right has been, the public has been misinformed, and they feel that it's a moral duty to tell the truth, but if they tell the truth, the price they pay is so heavy, and the opposition that they face is so extreme, that they have to be very courageous and willing to be isolated, almost banished, in order to follow the voice of conscience. The forces to oblige a person to not speak the truth are very strong. It requires someone very special to do that.
It is well established that there are people in this country who are treated very badly because they are born to a certain caste. And conversely, there are people who are treated very well by virtue of birth. Can we use the Bhagavad Gita to justify this? Is a person their circumstances, or are you judged on merit of personality and what you achieved? And it's a multifaceted question. It also states that if you are born in a caste, then you stay there. Now, that is, it is not human nature. People are lower, they would want to rise. So where does motivation fit into this picture?
It's a very complex question, because there are a number of factors involved. In the framework of the Hindu faith tradition, whatever birth you get is a direct result of your karma. So if you're born in a low caste, it means that you did karma to go in that low caste, therefore not very good karma. If you are born in a high caste, it means you must have done very, very good karma to be born in that high caste. As long as you're performing an action according to the spirit of right action, that's a good karma. But there may be karmic accounts that come from other times. So you have a lot of mixture of good karma, bad karma, karmic consequences that come from a long time ago. You may do a very good karma now, but the consequences of it will come way in the future. So it's the philosophy of karma is very, very difficult for people to work out. In the Bhagavad Gita, it does mention that whatever caste you're born in, you must remain with that dharma, with that caste duty. And one of the things that comes up very much in the environment of Hinduism, where people are less educated, is the force of superstition is enormous. And someone, a religious authority, can introduce an idea which may be biased against a certain group of people, and everyone will accept it without question because they're not used to questioning these things. If somebody is a good judge of character, that's very much an advantage. So I think what we're trying to do here is get people to think and get people to realize that everyone is a child of God and everyone is different. But if I treat somebody badly, that would be my negative karma.
That's the point I was hoping you'd reach, because a lot of people use the scripture to justify treating other people badly.
Well, then you have to look at another part of the scripture which says very clearly, if you treat somebody badly, you will pay for it. Yeah. So if you take a bit of the scripture out of context and say, well, this is the reason why I'm justified in behaving in this way, you know, somebody else will say, well, what about this bit of the scripture which says, excuse me, not so. And this is one of the difficulties that you find in all scriptures. There are so many different voices within the scriptures, because scriptures occurred gradually over a long period of time. And what we see in the Bhagavad Gita is we see some voices which are really for the Vedantic tradition. Then we see other shlokas where it's saying, you know, don't be limited by the Vedantic tradition. There's something else as well. As you study it, you begin to see these different voices which force you to have to choose, which again brings you to your own motivation. And I think what it's saying is, if you can be the most pure, the most sattvic, the most elevated of people, you are going to be loved by God. And that is really what it's about.
Sister Denise, caste, does it refer to the soul or the body?
Well, essentially, it's supposed to refer to the soul. But when you get born, into a family, you get a family name which designates your caste. And as soon as people ask you what your name is, they will judge you according to your caste, because that's the way that people interact with each other. And it's very much part of the prevailing social attitude. You know, the Gita was talking about different personality profiles, and you really have to look in terms of the quality of your behavior, your characteristics, how you're motivated, and then you will see if you are Brahmin type, or if you are Kshatriya type, or if you are Vaishya type, or if you are Shudra type, because the characteristics are clearly noted in the Gita independently of your physical birth.
Yeah, so it's about personality rather than birth.
Yeah, and it's about soul.
Sister Denise, one phrase that I think is one of the most deepest lessons that the Gita offers the reader is to not concern yourselves with the fruit of your actions. Now, Sister Denise, from a very human perspective, you get somebody who is who had a bad childhood and who doesn't actually know what it means to be loved. This soul is starved of love, which describes a huge chunk of the population. Now, if you find yourself in that position and you want to honor the Bhagavad Gita, how do you not concern yourself with the fruit of action?
I think that everyone in the world is, relatively speaking, spiritually depleted. Which means whether you've had a relatively good or relatively bad childhood, in the end, you're still going to desire the fruit of action. And the fact that the Gita takes up the idea that you should not desire the fruit of action is telling you that if you're going to engage on a spiritual practice, what you need to do is to cultivate faith in yourself, so that you know that if you're doing a good action, anyway, there's going to be a good result. You don't have to look for it. It's included in the good action. And what happens to people who are unsure of themselves is they'll do something and they'll look immediately for the fruit. And then if it doesn't come, they'll be all out of order. You see what I mean? And what the Gita is saying is don't let yourself get into a situation like that. Understand the laws and cultivate such a faith in yourself that you are able to, you know, take care of your own self and not become dependent on feedback from other people. Because as soon as somebody knows that you're dependent on the feedback, they're going to withhold it and play around with you. And you're going to be victimized. And that is what the Gita really doesn't want you to get into a situation like that.
Most of the people who read the Bhagavad Gita by choice are good people, would like to be better people, would like to be close to God. They have that in them anyway, hence their attraction, pull towards the scripture. How do they set about their internal processes so that their choices become such that almost every action they perform brings good karma and not the bad type of karma?
A person who grows up in a family where the Gita is read, they will have exposure from childhood, and they will be told about the knowledge of the Gita by their parents, by the religious leaders who their family is associated with. So they'll know, and they may be taught a few shlokas like that, just as anyone in any faith tradition has exposure. But I think that somebody who isn't born into a Hindu family which studies the Gita, who may be born in a different faith tradition, they will come upon the Gita through their studies or some friend or something like this. And so they will come at it from a different angle and also in a little bit more mature years, and they will look at it as a piece of literature. In a sense, this is what we've been doing in this series, looking at it as a piece of sacred literature. A person who grows up with the Gita will have a relationship with the Gita that changes over time. So I think it's a little bit difficult to give a hard and fast answer about it, but certainly the Gita is very deep. And a lot of the people that I've spoken to who have grown up around the Gita haven't actually read it. I ask people, have you read the Gita? And they will say to me, yes, but I mean, I've read a few bits of it. Because the Gita is deep. Now, we've been working with a translation from Sanskrit into English, which means it's very accessible to us. But, you know, most people who grow up in India, they may not know Sanskrit, you see. So you can't really read the Gita if you don't know Sanskrit. And then there are people who learn parts of it by heart, maybe as part of a school lesson or something like this. So the way in which people come to it is going to vary a great deal according to their age, their social structure, their if they're an intellectual family, a poetic family, a business family. There are so many strands of Hinduism and so many different kinds of relationships with the Gita and with the other scriptures. And you know, the Gita is part of a larger epic, which is the Mahabharata. And there are some people who think that, well, if you read this, it's going to create conflict in the family. So then they won't. They'll sort of know some of the ideas, but they won't sit down and read it because there's superstition that comes into it. I think the angle that we're looking at it from is definitely going to be colored by the context of our own literary, religious, and cultural background, you see. So we're looking at it in terms of morality, in terms of rightness, wrongness, in terms of how does God communicate with humanity, and what is all of this, the symbolism, and so on.
Okay, Sister Denise, I think we say goodbye to you right now because this is the end of this episode, unfortunately. Thank you so much for sharing what you did. There you go, brothers and sisters. What is meant by the subject of motivation? And the question that I would like to leave with you is, what motivates you to speech? What motivates you to action? And the Bhagavad Gita is very clear. If you do something with negative intentions, you will pay a negative price for it. You will be accumulating bad karma. It is as simple as that. It's a law that if you ignore it, it will be at your peril. So I ask you, I invite you to sit with yourself and consider the reason that you say things, the reason that you do things, and please make sure for your own sake that your reasoning is honorable. Otherwise, the consequences is something that you will have to pay. So thank you so much for joining us. And thank you, Sister Denise.
Thank you.
It's been great to spend the half an hour with you. Take care and goodbye.